Welcome to Living the Dream Outdoors, the official podcast of Living the Dream Outdoor Properties. We live by the motto, it's not just land, it's a lifestyle. And we live the outdoor lifestyle every day. Whether you're a landowner or dreaming of joining the ranks of those closest to the earth, we're your brothers and sisters of the outdoors. We hunt, we fish, we're stewards of the land. And our Living the Dream team will show you the way to enjoying the land and all the outdoor pursuits it has to offer. Here's your host, Bill Cooper.
Welcome to Living the Dream Outdoor Podcast. I'm at the Black Bear Bonanza down in Bentonville, Arkansas. And on this program with me is David McDaniel. He's with Bear Hunting Magazine, which comes out of Fayetteville, Arkansas. Also, I have on the program again Ryan Harris. He's a land agent with Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, and he's from down in Arkansas. Tells me he knows a little bit about bear hunting. We'll find out. Maybe you can quiz him.
That's not a good time.
I think actually he's here spying. You know, he's trying to figure a few things out. Well, David, Bear Hunting Magazine, how long has it been around?
So Bear Hunting Magazine's been around since the early 2000s, actually. It was owned by a gentleman originally who passed it to Clay Newcomb in 2011 or 12. And then Clay Newcomb ran and owned it for a few years. And then Colby Moorhead owns it now.
Colby Moorhead.
Yes, sir.
Is he a hometown boy?
He is actually originally from Northeast Texas like I am. He's from Dangerfield, but he lives here in Fayetteville now.
You're from Texas, too?
I am, yes, sir. Born and raised. I was born in Kilgore, Texas.
Kilgore. I know where Kilgore is. I used to be on a little college board in South Texas, and I run around South Texas a little bit.
Fantastic.
But how did you get hooked up with Bear Hunting Magazine?
Actually, through Brent Reeves, who I met on Instagram a few years ago. I live in the Tyler area now. And he has connections to that area. I followed Brent after I heard him on the Bear Grease podcast, and he followed me back, and we ended up connecting through that. And he asked where I was from. We went to coffee one day, became friends, and Brent used to do all of the photography, videography for the magazine for Clay. And so Brent introduced me to Colby. I have a history, a background in writing, going back to being a writing, I competed in writing when I was in high school and then started off as a journalism major in college. And
really?
Yeah, I've actually only been bear hunting for a couple of years now. I've killed two bears, but I love to write about anything. It's just a passion that I have. And so once I connected with Colby, we went on our first hunt together a couple of years ago and wrote my first article for the magazine, and I've wrote a couple since. So.
Well, that's pretty exciting. I love running into new and young journalists. I didn't go to journalism school as such. I was telling somebody earlier, I actually took a journalism course in high school way back when. Worst course I ever took in my life. I quit. I've been writing for 54 years.
Fantastic. Yeah, so I didn't finish college, but I started as a journalism major.
Right.
I grew up as an athlete, so my intention at that time was actually to write about sports. But as I became an outdoorsman, as I grew into adulthood, and it's just that passion for writing translated to that really well. So,
well, what first sparked your interest in writing? I got to dig into this just a little bit.
Yeah,
man, it's really something that I have enjoyed since I was a kid. You know, my father taught me at a young age that readers are leaders. That the written word is a very powerful thing, and the idea of story being very important just to our humanity and to our reality. And so that sparked my interest. I started writing poetry, and literally when I was a child, I would started writing and enjoyed writing. And my father also was a writer and author. He's published 5 books that I helped him edit a lot of those. And he used to write for Fox News, and I edited all the stuff that he did for Fox News. And we had stuff that we did that actually got picked up by the Associated Press and things of that nature. So
that's awesome.
I have kind of a random background associated with that, and it's just something I really enjoy doing. So, especially now with the outdoor industry, I think it's just a powerful way to tell our story to the general public, both people who are passionate about hunting and not. So,
well, it's inspiring to me. I'm 75 years old to see young and aspiring writers, because there's just not a whole lot of them out there anymore. Of course, yourself, it's not a real lucrative business, because we've watched how many big magazines go out of business. Like for one, I used to write for Cabela's Outfitters Journal. Gone. Right. You know, I did 28 years with Game and Fish publications. They used to have a publication in every state. Now they've condensed it. One magazine covers like 8 states. The one we get, I don't know if he even has a Missouri writer anymore. And I've just watched one after another, you know, newspapers are going the same route, you know.
Sure.
And boy, you know, 30, 40 years ago, you'd have never convinced me that this kind of stuff was going to happen.
That's
but
right.
Another example was web photographs, for instance. All of us used to have to provide the magazine with Chrome 64 slides, and we would get $75 to $250 bucks a piece for those. Well, I was at a convention, a writer convention at Bass Pro some 30, 35 years ago, and Dick Idle was there. He's a sculpture writer from out west. And
how cool.
Yeah, Dick had already heard about digital coming on and had a little experience with it. He said, boys, guess what? Get ready for the shock. That $250 slide in 2 years will be worth 5 cents. Exactly right.
Wow.
And it's tough to even sell a photograph these days. Most articles, I do a lot of online stuff. They just expect the photographs to come along with it.
Correct. Part of it.
Things change constantly. So yeah. What about Bear Hunting Magazine? How has it changed over the couple of decades?
Well, I can't speak to that in fullness because I wasn't a part originally. Obviously, we've expanded our media outlets just like everybody else. You've had right. to. So we have a strong online presence on Instagram and Facebook. We've had a podcast in the past, a little foreshadowing. We may have one again soon. And then also, you know, we had a really strong YouTube presence for a long time too. So while the written media is still central to what we're doing and always will be, you know, we always claim, because we are the only solely bear focused written publication in the world. So nobody else is focused solely on bears like we are. And so that's kind of a niche for us that we, you know, we have no plans to go away from that.
Well, sounds like a good plan, but for somebody that is not familiar with Bear Hunting Magazine, how's it set up? What kind of features, what kind of articles can you look for in Bear Hunting Magazine?
Man, we actually do everything from, you know, just lay people who might would want to submit one from our readers to, we have columnists that write, you know, about specific things. We have a legendary hounds article that's been a long time fixture in the magazine.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
Jana Waller, who you can find, she has a really strong social media and hunting media presence. She writes a standing column in the magazine as well. You'll see everything from, you know, how to's and, you know, how to DIY hunt, you know, out west, or how to start a bear bait if you've never baited before, to, you know, hunting with hounds, you know, hunting all over the country. And so you'll find a lot, you know, from both different sources and also for everybody from the brand new hunter to the experienced hunter.
Well, sound like you covered all the bases, but it's kind of interesting to me that you mentioned, I thought maybe it coming out of Arkansas, this might be a Southern Bear Hunt magazine. Hunting those bears that say you all.
Yeah. Well, anybody who's not saying y'all just doesn't know how to say it proper. So, but yeah, we hunt bears from, say, y'all and you guys.
Yeah,
you know,
okay,
up
guys.
North, so or yeah, eh? We hunt the bears that say, eh?
Eh? So, yeah, I've hunted in that territory.
Yeah.
But isn't it interesting, though, regardless where you go, but folks that hunt bears are kind of a special group of people.
It's true. Especially depending on where you're at in the country, the perception can be really different, right? From me being in East Texas, it's super rare. Like anytime I talk about bear hunting, which I'm passionate about, I love to talk about it. People are very surprised. They know very little about it. They don't even understand how I could ever get into it starting off in East Texas. You know, most people are like, can you even eat bear? You know,
we got to talk about that.
Yeah. So, you know, it is a really kind of niche passion. You know, I think 4% of the country hunts, and I think 4% of hunters hunt bears. So we're a niche inside of a niche at this point.
Well said,
but it's a lot of fun. Man, you know, being a part of a niche is something that, you know, gives you a special place in certain spaces. So
it certainly does. But I've hunted bears in New Brunswick, way up, you know, northeast. And I was surprised because I've watched a lot of bear hunting videos in Canada, not New Brunswick specifically, but some other areas. There's some big bears up there, you
Absolutely.
Know. But New Brunswick, they run pretty small.
Okay.
Yeah. At the camp we were in, they've been in business for decades. The average bear taken is like 125 pounds.
Oh, wow.
And I was there one week, and I killed the largest bear out of five, weighed 157 pounds. But I swear, when I was looking at it over the bait, it looked like it was 500 pounds, you know?
Absolutely. They all look like they're 500 pounds at first.
They do. They're a lot of fur there.
Yes, sir.
But you mentioned somebody asked you about eating bear. And of course, I've always been a philosophy, hey, but if you kill it, you're going to eat it, you know?
Absolutely.
And I was really curious about bear, and I got read in with the guide skinning the bear and did the whole nine yards, you know, the whole process. And there was an awful lot of fat on that bear, and I was a little concerned about all that. But boy, we cleaned that meat up, and I took that home, and I worked on it. I got it down pat for about an 8-pound bear roast, you know.
Yep.
I just really worked those things over and marinated it a little bit. I put a rub on it and put bacon over that thing, and I was injecting apple juice about every hour, man. And that came out. I had that thing on the smoker, I want to say 8 or 10 hours, and of course formed a crust on it. But when I sliced that first thin slice off of that piece of meat rolled over, that was the prettiest pink on the inside. And man,
it is good.
It was as good as any steak I ever had in my life.
My family loves it too. It's actually my family's preferred meat. So, and we always do the roast first. My wife cooks it Mississippi style. I don't know if you've ever done that with pepperoncinis and a rub and things.
No.
Like that. I have a recipe for that on Instagram that you can find. But that's my favorite style to eat it. But we eat the ground with everything. My kids prefer it over venison or beef. So
really?
Yeah. It works out really well, because that is a reason my wife is very supporting of my desire to hunt bears. So that works out.
I was fortunate enough to win a coon hunt with David and Brent Reeves. Me and my wife got to go over into the Delta of Arkansas and hunt coons with them. And they brought bear sausage on the trip. That's the first time I'd ever had it. And we had that with our breakfast, and it was phenomenal.
That sounds good. Now, you talk about bear for breakfast. It's been 5 or 6 years ago. There was an outdoor writer friend of mine that lived with me for about 18 months. And he, I'm telling you, he was my favorite outdoor writer and photographer of all times. And this guy, he just floored me one time. We were on the Jack's Fork River and floated on into the current river. We were out for like 5 days. And this guy made a huge confession. He said, you know, Ron Kruger was his name. He was the editor of the Hunting and Fishing Journal many years ago, which is like the Playboy outdoor magazines, man. He said, Cooper, I want to tell you something. It's like, oh, boy, what's coming, you know? And he said, everybody thinks I got all these college degrees and everything. He said, I never finished high school. I said, you're lying to me.
Goodness.
And he had come from a large family in St. Louis, and his father had died when he was like 13 or 14. So he had to go to work. Well, sure. I said, how in the world did you ever transpire into becoming a famous outdoor writer? He said, well, there was a little dirty creek that ran through our neighborhood, and I got to dinking around in there and caught some little bluegill and got all fascinated. Some old man give me a copy of Outdoor Life. I was fascinated. Wore that thing out. And he said, more I read it, more I thought, well, if those guys can do that, I can do it too, you know. So he went to high school and got an English book, studied it like the Bible, went to junior college and took some English and journalism courses, and nobody there ever asked me if I had a high school degree. I just took what I wanted and quit.
Oh, man. How cool is that?
And he said, I wrote his first article and sent it off, you know, just blindly, no query letter or anything. He said, oh, dude sent me a check for $30. He said, I'll never look back.
$30, that's all it took to get him hooked.
Yeah, to get him started. But yeah. I love stories like that. But he was an incredible human being. And after he left my home, he went down on Jack's Fork River and rented a little tiny cabin that set up on top of a bluff. You couldn't see another building anywhere. He had a little gazebo. He'd go out in that gazebo right on the edge of this rock bluff, 100 foot down, the creek flowed by. He'd go out there in his underwear every morning, smoke his pipe, drink his coffee, and he hunted, fished, and trapped every day of the world.
Wow.
Didn't have a care in the world, you know.
Fantastic.
Man, how the rest of us get to that level?
Right. No doubt. There's probably not many playbooks that lead to that, right?
Not really, but what a fascinating human being. But that's one of the incredible things about being in the outdoor industry, whether it's in outdoor communications, retail, inventing products, sitting here looking at a tree stand that weighs 5 pounds. Some young man just has put on the market, and he's going to do well, I'd say. Guys selling outdoor real estate. Yep. You know, I have met some incredible personalities in my 54 years in this business, but I'm always meeting somebody that ups the bar, you know.
Absolutely.
I have to hand it to you young folks. You guys are so far ahead of us. I said, if I was as smart as a lot of these kids are these days, I'd have been dangerous.
Well, if you think we're so far ahead of you, you ought to get me over here on this recording machine and see how quickly I can mess it up.
Yeah, well, I will say, too, I mean, I would like to acknowledge the fact that I do feel like we're standing on strong shoulders. You know, I'd like to thank you personally as just somebody who's been a part of that. You know, I mean, I think that we've had a really incredible launch pad into the industry, and a lot of the resources that are available to us and are still available to us, even by way of the outdoor resources, places to hunt and things, they're here because of guys like you.
Well, I appreciate that, but I felt like for a long time as outdoor communicators, we didn't do a very good job of bringing new folks in, because there's a limited number of jobs out there and the competition can be keen sometimes. And I've seen outdoor communicators kind of cut each other's throats, you know, and sure. We see it in the outdoor industry sometimes too, because it's a small kind of tight knit group. And hey, this might sound harsh, but it takes a bit of talent to break in.
No, sure.
And one of the biggest things is a personality. You know, I've seen people with, hey, great writing talents or whatever, but they just don't get along with people.
Right.
And you've got to be a people person to get into this business. But it just thrills me to death to see young folks getting involved, you know. And I've been in the Missouri Outdoor Communicators for 35 years, was one of the original founding members, and it got funny. If we got so old, you know, I think, man, we're just going to die off. We're going to be done. Well, somebody finally attracted a young man into the group. Man, we gave him scholarships, took him on all kinds of trips, and then he must have told some others because they kind of started flowing in, and we just wear them out, you know, trying to give them opportunities, hook them up with writing jobs or video jobs or whatever.
That's awesome.
And it's worked very well, and I'm proud. Funny story, Tim Chelzovic, who is the editor of DeerCast, Drury DeerCast, he came into our group, and Ray I, a big-time turkey hunter, has done a radio program for a long time, and Timmy, we called him Tiny Tim, he's a little bitty guy, asked about joining or setting in on Ray for a radio show in a St. Louis studio, and I knew what Ray would do to him. They got started. Ray just slides the microphone right over in front of him. The interview starts, and Timmy's part of the program, you know, and he was just a natural. He just knocked it out of the park. We all fell in love with Timmy, and Ray I was very influential in getting Timmy his job with Drury Outdoors as well. Now cool. Little Timmy is my boss.
Yeah. Oh, wow. He still lets you call him Tiny Tim?
No. Yeah. Yes, sir.
It's Big Tim.
That's
now.
Right. Yeah. That's one way to get your nickname changed, yeah. To become the boss.
Yeah, well, exactly.
And you said it right. I mean, no matter what you do, whether it's selling land or being in the outdoor media realm or, you know, whatever it may be, you've got to have a little bit of talent to go along with the passion. And don't let this guy fool you right here. He's talented at what he does. His photography and his writing, he's got the knack for it.
Hey, it don't take long to figure that out. But, guys, I tell you what, I hate to close this show out. It's been a lot of fun, but I appreciate you being on.
Absolutely.
Tell people how they can get the magazine.
You can go to bearhuntmagazine.com. You can find them on Instagram, Facebook. If you just Google Bear Hunting Magazine, we're the only magazine called Bear Hunting Magazine. So we're pretty easy to find. There's a subscription link on there, and we would love to have people subscribe for sure.
You bet. Well, folks, Ryan Harris, David McDaniel, myself, Bill Cooper, we're living our outdoor dreams. We encourage you to get outdoors and live your outdoor dreams as well.
Hi, I'm Steve Stoltz with Drury Outdoors, and you're listening to Living the Dream Outdoors Podcast with Bill Cooper and Hunter Heineman.
Slow down and enjoy the simple things in life. Welcome to Huzzah Valley Resort, providing family fun since 1979. They offer floating, and you can choose from canoes, rafts, kayaks, and inner tubes on a beautiful, crystal clear Ouzal River. Lodging, let us be your home away from home. Choose from a variety of lodging units while still enjoying the great outdoors. With over 2.5 miles of river camping on the crystal clear Ouzal, we're sure you and your family will find the perfect spot to pitch your tent or park your RV. Have fun and let us help you get the most of your stay. Check out our guided trail rides and Karen's Cafe menu. There's something for everyone at Ouzal. There's a campground store on site that has everything you need for your trip. Whether you're in need of gear, grub, or something else, chances are they've got it. And their campground has RV sites and primitive sites for all your camping needs. If you like the adventures of camping with a cozy bed at night, we have a variety of different lodging units to choose from. But Ouzal Valley, there's always something going on out there. Check them out on Facebook, or if you want to make a reservation, simply call 1-800-367-4516.
Hi, I'm Steve Stoltz with Woodhaven Custom Calls, Mossy Oak Camouflage, and Drury Outdoors. My turkey tip for the week this week is don't be scared to use a decoy. There's a lot of myths about decoys, but I can tell you this. The Avian X Trophy Tom decoy is one decoy I will not hunt without. Doesn't mean I carry it all the time. There is the time and place for a decoy. But if you need a decoy, use one. For instance, open areas, fields, places that you're set up where you know the turkey is going to see you from a distance. Man, those decoys really work. Those Avian X is what my personal favorite decoy is. And I use an Avian X HDR Jake, a lookout hen, and a feeder hen. I like to use three decoys if I can. It just makes it look more natural. Turkeys like to go to the flock. They like, they're social birds. So when they see multiple birds rather than just one, they're far more inclined to come to your location. And be smart about how you set your decoys. Don't set your decoys straight out in front of you, and don't set them where the turkeys will see you in between, basically putting you between the decoy's vision and the turkeys. Set them out to one side or the other. So you want to put them, if the turkey's coming from your left, you want to put the decoys a little bit to your right, about 10, 15 yards. And that's the other thing. Don't put the decoys too far from your location. You want the turkeys to come in close for a shot. You hear a lot about reaping with a decoy. Well, let me tell you, it works. And I don't leave home without my Trophy Tom. And I use a real turkey fan that I spread out, salt down, and let it dry out. And I put it in that Trophy Tom. And I can tell you this, every single gobbler that I took last spring was directly a result of using the Trophy Tom, using that visual to bring that gobbler in for the shot. I'm Steve Stoltz, and that's my turkey hunting tip for the week.
Hey, everybody. This is Alex Rutledge with American Roots Outdoors. Check out my buddy's podcast show, Living the Dream Outdoors, with Bill Cooper and Hunter Hindman. You're really going to enjoy this week's show.
Welcome back to Living the Dream Outdoor podcast here in segment two. Hunter Hindman and I, hey, we talk quite a lot.
You do.
Hunter's quite a storyteller. I think he takes it from his dad. I've heard him tell some pretty wild tales too. But Hunter, you know, man, I've been turkey hunting for, wow, 5 decades, man. And there's some crazy, crazy things that can happen out there in the woods. And funny stories. You know, it's great. Any hunting situation. That's one of the best parts of it, is sitting around a campfire listening to a guy to tell stories. And some of them, you know, you believe, some of them you don't believe. But one of the craziest things I ever had happen, this was probably back in the 1980s. I was hunting on a best turkey hunt spot I ever had in my life. An elderly couple owned several hundred acres here in the Ozarks and covered up in deer and turkey. And that's back when there was lots of turkeys. But this particular morning, I was having a little bit of trouble, and I'd started out on the ridge I usually always hunted and just couldn't strike anything up. But I heard a turkey gobble across this little river, and part of that farm laid across the river, just 10 or 20 acres. It was just a couple of hills and a saddle there, and this gobbler was roosted right in that saddle. And I thought, man, I can kill that dude. But problem was, the river was up just a little bit. It had rained the night before.
Yeah.
And I had one place I would cross is shallow shoal. And I'm not kidding you. I waited to cross that. Had to turn my little headlight on, you know, just to make sure I didn't get too wet. And I was within an inch of going over the top of my knee boots. And halfway across, I stopped and I called again, just really get a good fix on it. Gobbled. Well, he gobbled again. Well, I had to go pretty slow and easy to get across. And I got to the other side, and it was light enough that shooting irons had started. And I hit the other bank. And rather than climb up that bank, I still want to make sure where that gobbler was so that I didn't silhouette myself or anything like that. So I'm at the bottom of the bank. I call one more time. And in that minute or so that it took me to cross that creek, that gobbler had flown off the roost towards me. He was on the ground. And when I called that last time, he ran up to the top of the bank. I mean, he's probably less than 10 yards from me. Looked over the bank at me and gobbled. And so I just threw up and shot real quick, flipped him over backwards, and I thought I'd killed him stone dead. You know, so I went running up there, and I saw him running through the woods, and he jumped off of a short bluff. It had to have been 60 yards away, so I had a full choke or an extra full choke and shot the second time. That gobbler folded up and fell right in the middle of the river.
Uh-oh.
Hey, not a good scenario because it's deep water down there. So I hustled back across the shoal, and I ran down the river, probably got 150 yards ahead of this turkey, and he's spread eagle. His wings are out, his head's underwater, and he's drifting away. I stripped down to my underwear, man. I'm going to swim after this gobbler. I'm not letting this gobbler float off down the river. So I swam out and reached, got a hold of the tip of one wing, and this bird came back to life, man. He started flopping and scratching at me, even pecking at me. And its head had been underwater this whole time, but it's just like he came back to life, man. This turkey's messing me up. But I'm going underwater and floating down the river with him, and I finally turned loose of him and swam back to the bank and got a club about 2 foot long and, I don't know, about the size of a baseball bat. I swam back out there and grabbed a hold of the turkey again, just got the tip of his wing, and he's, man, he is very lively. But I start beating on this turkey, you know. I took pictures of this thing. I got him back to the bank. Half the feathers was gone off of him. But back then, remember, you had to check these things in.
Right.
So I previously had been superintendent of Merrimack Spring Park. And that's where I took my turkeys to check them in. I knew everybody out there, all the conservation department guys. Mm-hmm. They laughed. And I still, those guys still laugh at me when I run into them. It's been 30 years ago. They yeah. still bring that story up. But you know what? I'm just standing right away from rivers in my old age because one falls in the river now, I'm not swimming after him.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't even want to do that either.
Well, I heard you tell some pretty good turkey hunting tales a time or two.
Yeah, I've been a part of some hunting camps and it, you know, all over, and it is kind of fun to, that's probably one of the funnest parts is just listening to people talk about it and their experience and just sitting around a campfire and listening to other people's stories, whether it's a turkey or a deer or something across the world, you know.
Coat of Mondays.
Yeah. Yep. It's just kind of funny. So I had a pretty good one. Gosh, this is probably going back 3 years now. I was hunting with Dad out at his farm, 550 acres in Crawford County, southern Crawford County. And we were hunting and we got on these three birds. And we have permission to hunt the neighbor's farm and then the other adjoining neighbors. So we have three farms we hunt, my dad's and the two adjoining ones. And these birds were not too far on our neighbor's property. And we're like, okay, let's, you know, let's go after them. They were gobbling heavy and a lot in the morning. And there was we couldn't tell if it was two or what was going on, but there ended up being three of them. And, they were all hanging out together, and I think this was the first week that it opened, like opening week, and we get in there on them, and we're like 150 yards away, and we call one more time, and we could tell they were coming our way, so we just sat down, and again, it was like you'd call and one would gobble and all, the other two would gobble. They'd all sound off. And so they start coming, and finally they get about like 70, 80 yards, you know, just too far for me to shoot. And that was one of those scenarios where we didn't have time to really set up a decoy or anything like that. And they just kind of ended up moving off, and they moved off and gobbled a couple more times, and they were a couple hundred yards away at that point. Well, we ended up getting out of there and went on my dad's farm in another area and the next day, and kind of the same area where those birds were, we started hearing them again, all three of them going off gobbling. So we went in the timber again and took off after him. And we got like really close. We were probably standing and he sounded off it, and they were probably 80, 90 yards away, but it was thick enough we were covered. So when they gobbled that one time, we just sat down, and by the time my butt hit the ground, I could see him walking through the woods.
Coming to you.
Huh? Yep. And, I had sat down and my gun was on my lap. It wasn't even up on my knee ready or anything. And, they come in again. We didn't have time to set a decoy up. We're just in there, and they come up at about 45, 50 yards through some real thick stuff. And I couldn't see the heads of the other two, and I could see one, and he wasn't strutted up or anything. And I whispered Dad, I'm like, what do you think? He's like, if you can shoot him, shoot. He goes, I can't even see him. My dad was hunting with his 410 pistol. So I went ahead and shot one, and it fell down. And of course, when you're turkey hunting, you just, you know, you take off and make sure you go get it. So, because they're tough. I hit it and it fell. It's flopping around. And by the time I got up to turkey, it was gone. And I looked up top of the hill, and he's running up the hill, runs over the hill. And so I take off over the hill, and I still got two in the chute. So I still got two shells left. And this turkey, I get up there, and I don't know, I'm standing there. I looked over to my right, looked back to the left, and this turkey all of a sudden is just running from my right to left at about 25 yards, and it's pretty messed up. Like his wing was maybe broke. I'm not really sure, but he's running sideways at like 25 yards and just like kind of clucking and making all kinds of noises. And so I throw the gun up and shoot at him while he's running, and I was all flustered and out of breath, missed. He circles around, and instead of just running away from me or farther to the left, he like circled back around, kind of bumped into a tree and turned right towards me. And I threw my gun up again. And at this point, I think he was 10 yards and I missed. Felt like a big idiot then, but my pattern was so tight, I was freaking out. And
yeah, that close.
So then at that point, the turkey's running right at me. I'm out of shells, and I just set the gun down on the ground, basically. Turkey ran right into me and just grabbed him right by the neck and laid down on him. He ran right into me, but that turkey was, he's running straight at me as fast as I could. It was like a charging turkey.
Yeah, so just grabbed him by the neck.
Yeah.
Was that a pretty good wrestling match once you hit the ground? You didn't get spurred, did
you?
Yeah,
I grabbed him. I had one hand around his neck and the other around both of his feet. He was just a two-year-old bird, maybe an 8-inch beard. But, man, it was a good one to remember.
Oh, I would imagine so. I bet your dad had some good remarks to make about that.
Yeah, you know, another good one, and I think you heard it down in Mexico, was the good one about Bill Lovelace. We might have to get him on a podcast on here, because that was a good one, too.
He's a wild man.
That's another good charging turkey one. That's kind of an inside joke, but
yeah, but Bill could tell some great stories. You know, after we left turkey camp, I was going to tarpon fishing camp by myself, and Bill felt sorry for me, so he volunteered to go, all expenses paid, you know. Hey, we had a great time that week. We laughed and joked, and other than me being sick for a day or two there, it was a pretty good time. We ate at some good restaurants, and hey, I'd take that dude back, man. He was a ton of fun. But man, great stories, nothing like it. And hey, folks, we encourage you, you know, to record those stories. I've done that a bit over the years. That's where some of my article material come from, you know. And I'm not above making fun of somebody. So
I know guys that will journal it too, and like write, you know, every day they go out and, you know, and write some stuff down about their experience and what date it was, and they just do a little paragraph thing about what happened and that day or whatever, and then they have it when they come back, and then you can, kind of cool to look back on that. Sometimes they'll send it to me and I read it. And,
yeah, would be. I never really kept a journal like that. I guess my journals where I've been writing for 52 years. So I look back at stories a lot of times, and and boy, just a great flood of memories that come back, you know. But those stories like that, hey, you never. That's the stories you tell your grandchildren. And I'm actually telling some of my stories to my grandkids now. But I had a dear friend I went to church with many. That's been 30 years ago as well. But he had a story similar to yours. He actually went out. It was last Sunday morning of season, and he went out turkey hunting before he came to church, and he was on a ridge and had a gobbler that was running through the woods straight at him. I don't know if something spooked it or what, but he had an original Belgian Browning shotgun. He shot the turkey, knocked it down, it got up, still running towards him. He shot it the second time, shot it the third time, and it's still running at him. And he takes his Belgian Browning, swings it like a baseball bat, and clotheslines the turkey, broke his neck, killed him stone dead. But he bent the barrel that Belgian Browning. So be careful how you use those guns, folks. But, hey, from Hunter Hyman and myself, we're living our outdoor dreams. We encourage you to do the same. Get outdoors and live those outdoor dreams. I'm Bill Cooper.
And I'm Hunter Hyman, your co-host.
Captain Brian Wilson runs one of the tightest bow fishing operations in the business. Stainwater Bow Fishing operates out of Jerome, Missouri, and the beautiful Missouri Ozarks. They cover most Ozark streams and lakes. You haven't lived until you've searched Ozark waters during the night with Stainwater Bow Fishing while looking for giant gar, carp, and buffalo. Captain Wilson also runs a second boat on Taneycomo Lake. Call today to book a trip with Stainwater Bow Fishing at 573-263-8016. Again, that's 573-263-8016. Be sure and shoot straight.
The Living the Dream Outdoors podcast is brought to you by Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, The Fly Rod Journals, SmokerBuilder.com, Cowtown USA, Westover Farms, Scenic Rivers Taxidermy, Stained Water Bow Fishing, Scenic Rivers Guide Service and Tours, Huzzah Valley Resort, Pico Lures, Devil's Backbone Outfitters, The Fallen Outdoors, Ledco Sinkers and Lure Company, Turnbow Outdoors, J&J Charters, Kaufman Cove, Alaska, Big Ed's Guide Service, Bean Creek Game Calls, Misty Mountain Guide Service, ASL Guides and Outfitters with Ryan Walker, On the Hook TV, Expedition Trailers, The Rambling Angler, Spare Rib Inn in Steelville, Missouri, and Rich's Famous Burgers.
Land ownership is the American dream. Land is the basis of all life. Our wise use of this most precious of resources ensures the survival and growth of free institutions and our American way of life. At Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, we value the traditions and freedoms that land provides us. Every day we seek the solace of a mountain sunrise over traffic jams and smog, the calming silence of a bubbling stream over the sirens of the city, and the quiet of the countryside over the hustle and bustle of the world. We hunt, we fish, we farm. We live off the land. It's our mission to help our clients live out their dreams on the land as we do. At Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, we believe that it's not just land, it's a lifestyle. Join us 5 days a week on Living the Dream Outdoor Podcast as the Living the Dream Outdoor Dream Team explores the most desired outdoor properties in the Midwest and whisks you away to incredible hunting, fishing, and outdoor recreation opportunities. Host Bill Cooper, an inductee of the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, will be joined by members of the Living the Dream Outdoors team each week as they tell tall tales, unveil tips and tactics, and rub elbows with some of the biggest names in the outdoor world. You'll also find the Living the Dream Outdoors podcast on your favorite social media platforms, including Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok.